Hey, everybody. Thank you for tuning in to the No Shortage of Questions podcast. It's Nick, and I'm joined by Andy. Andy, how are you doing today?
Nick, I'm doing just awesome here in Minnesota. It's a fabulous time of year. How are you doing there in Dallas, Texas?
I'm doing well. It's a little warm out, but I will tell you, I'm a little bit messy today because I was just over in the sanctuary and my entire left side of my pants are now covered in candle wax. So that's pretty cool. Have you ever done that? Right.
No, never. 30 years of ministry, Nick, that has never happened to me. How were you not being careful or what happened?
I wasn't paying attention. I was moving a candle and apparently the candle holder that it was in is like has a hole in the bottom and it just dripped all down my leg and I didn't even recognize it until I got back to my office. So there you go. Great day.
I have spilled candle wax on other people. Christmas Eve, you know, we do the passing of the flame and, I had a big candle that, had a bit too much wax, spilled it all over somebody. They were very understanding though.
Well, I wouldn't mind getting it on my skin, but now that it's on my pants, I just don't know, but I am wearing a brand new pair of Hey Dude shoes today. And I don't know if I got any, I just now thought to look at my shoes. I hope that I didn't get any of my shoes. I don't care about the pants as much as the shoes.
I do not know that brand, Nick. I'll have to check that out. Is that from Dick's Sporting Goods?
Very comfortable. I think they have them at Dick's Sporting Goods. Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
All right.
Hey, good, I got a question good. For you, Andy.
Yes. Yes.
How often do you erase and change what's written on your whiteboard behind you? Because we've been doing this now for months, and it's the same thing on your whiteboard behind you for months.
That is correct. You know, I change it when necessary. And right now on the whiteboard, I think I've had it on there for, you're right, a couple of months. It's how to delegate, how to give away ministry. And the secret to giving away ministry is, I do, you watch, I do, you help, you do, I help, you do, I watch, and four stages. And, a biblical scholar, Michael Breen, came up with that as the model for giving away the ministry and then was horrified to discover that someone in the business world had also come up with that before him. So he does give credit. It's a name that you would all know that's escaping me right now. But yeah, it's you know, one of the things we have trouble with in ministry is giving away the ministry. It's so much, yeah, I'll just do it myself. It'll be faster. But then you're not including other people. And one of our values here, Nick, is to give away the ministry. We include others for their sake, their need to be included, not just because we need more people to do something. And so there you go.
I was just wondering, do you need me to like send you an eraser for the whiteboard? I mean, it has been there up a long time.
That is true. You know how hard it is to find? I mean, erasers and whiteboard markers just disappear. And you try them in a meeting and they just don't work. But
they're like paper clips. They just disappear. I just got a new package of whiteboard markers the other day because they just disappear.
Oh yeah, yeah. So
Andy, do you know what tomorrow is? Do you know what tomorrow is?
I have no idea what tomorrow is, Nick.
It is round one of the NFL draft. Are you excited?
Oh yes, it is. That is going to be awesome. I hope the Vikings are preparing to figure out how to beat the Lions here with
Good luck with that. But I heard that you met the Vikings coach last week, that right?
I did not meet the Vikings coach, but last Thursday night, the Vikings coach was one at the one of the Lutheran churches south of us or west, whatever, southwest of us here at St. Philip the Deacon Lutheran Church in Plymouth, Minnesota. And they do this fabulous thing. The pastor there is an old friend of mine from St. Olaf and a classmate at St. Olaf. And they do this really cool thing. He started it over 20 years ago called Faith and Life. And they bring in speakers to talk about the connection between faith and whatever secular area of work they're in. And last Thursday, they had the head coach of the Minnesota Vikings in, Kevin O'Connell. And I thought this would be a great father-son event. So I brought Peter down there. And at the end, they did Q&A. And I'm sitting there and Peter goes, Dad, can I go ask a question? And I'm not going to squash initiative. I'm not going to squash bravery. I mean, I'm not going up there to ask the question of the coach. But he wanted to go. And so I said, sure, you go. And so he went and asked a question. It went pretty well. It was kind of funny seeing him in line because he was like just so much shorter than all the rest of these people, all these adults. And then Pete's in fifth grade right now. But he asked a really good question, I thought. And all these other people were asking about draft choices. What was it like to work with Belichick? All this kind of stuff. Because he had, I mean, this coach, I mean, he was a player under Belichick. He was a backup to Tom Brady. I mean, he's just played with great people. And so they were asking good questions. But Pete, my son Pete, he wanted to get to the faith part of this. So he gets up and he says, it was really kind of funny. He goes, Coach. And then he goes, Peter Romsted, lifelong fan. I mean, he's 11. It was awesome. And
that's great.
He goes, I want to know if there was ever been a moment or a game where you see something happen and you just know right then and there, that was God. And the place just erupted. I thought it was so awesome because he was putting O'Connell on the spot at many levels theologically. And the coach had a really good answer. He leaps out of his chair, puts his arm way up in the air, and starts imitating a Justin Jefferson catch. It wasn't against the Lions there, Nick, but...
Was it against Buffalo?
It must have been that catch. And then O'Connell, he goes 70, he says, Justin pulls out this miraculous catch. And then he goes, 70,000 people right then and there in Orange Park, New York are saying that was God right there at the place. Yeah. He, got That's a really awesome. Good response.
What a great question.
Yeah. Yeah.
Love that. He must be paying attention to you.
Clearly, Nick.
Because we are good at asking questions, aren't we, Andy?
Isn't that have something to do with the name of this podcast?
Yeah, say a little bit more about that.
If anyone asks, I mean, what is the name of this podcast mean? No shortage of questions. It's kind of like, you know, you can have a theological discussion. You can talk about the Bible. You can talk about God. And you continually ask questions. There is never a shortage of where, I mean, the early podcasts we were doing, I mean, we're way longer than we are now, just in part because there is so much rich material in all of what we try to unpack here. And so there's no shortage. That's really I don't know that it's the best name for a podcast. Nobody really quite gets it, but that's kind of the idea. Nick, any thoughts on that?
It's definitely not catchy.
I know.
That's right. But I think it's an appropriate name.
It's a proper, we need
it's
to
exactly
change
what
it.
We're doing here though. It's exactly what we're doing. Yeah. We're coming up with questions, and based on today's introduction, this podcast may be about as long as our original one.
Sorry. That's my fault.
It's great. But we do have a lot of new listeners. A lot of people are listening and we thank you for listening. I was at my Synod assembly this past week and a lot of people came up to me and said they're listening. So we are really grateful for each and every one of you listening out there. We thank you. And we hope that as we work our way through these questions and work our way through these scriptures, that you are engaging and trying to come up with new questions and trying to answer the questions to the best of your ability. We did have one question, though. What translation do we use? What translation do we use when we read the scriptures? And that is the NRSV, the New Revised Standard Version. And I think we're actually using the NRSVUE, the updated edition. So there you go, the NRSV. And we are... So honored that you listen. Next week, today we're finishing 1 Peter chapter 5. So we're finishing 1 Peter. Next week we're going to start 2 Peter. Might as well finish the whole Peter story. So,
Nick, Andy,
yeah.
Why do we use the NRSV? I mean, normal people use the NIV, and the cutting edge version now is the ESV. Do you want me to answer this question? People would ask that because a lot of you cannot always find the NRSV. You can find the NRSV UE, as you pointed out, on BibleGateway.com. By the way, if you're looking for a good Bible software, or whatever site online, BibleGateway.com is good. But Nick, why do we use the NRSV?
Because it's the best translation of the original text.
That's true. But if that were the best, why do other people not use it then?
Andy, why don't you tell me what you think?
Okay. You cannot find a translation that doesn't have at least a minor theological bent to it. And people are passionate about translations. When I was newer, younger in ministry, the upcoming translation was the New Living Translation, especially Edition 2, that for a couple of years there was the highest selling. Prior to that, it was the NIV, which is the most widely used. And more recently, the ESV, the English Standard Version, is being adopted by both. I see Missouri Synod Lutherans using that and also many evangelicals using that. The NRSV is just kind of the mainline church translation, which pays attention to gender, and also it has a nice mix of word for word and also idea for idea. The two big ideas in translations are thought for thought. So it doesn't matter if you're translating the exact words, but you're trying to make sure the same idea gets across. That's one approach to translation. The probably the most extreme version of that is the Living Bible, which is sometimes, I think it was originally designed for children.
I think the most extreme version of that is the Message.
Okay. Yeah. Even more so. Even
Eugene
more so.
Eugene Peterson's, good. Where it's just idea for idea.
Good. And on the other side of that, the New American Standard Version is not the one we use. The New American Standard Version is the one that's the most word for word. And the problem with that is often it just reads in a clumsy fashion. And it's not the way people would speak, and it's difficult. So NRSV is a nice mix of the two of those. And I mean, some of the really the best scholars. So if you're looking for a study Bible, the NRSV is excellent. And so, Nick, any corrections on that one? What do you think?
I think you said that perfectly. You summarized it perfectly. Great answer. There we go. I think we can jump right into 1 Peter 5.
All right.
Let's start right at verse 1, verses 1 through 3. Now, as an elder myself and a witness of the sufferings of Christ, as well as one who shares in the glory to be revealed, I exhort the elders among you to tend the flock of God that is in your charge, exercising the oversight, not under compulsion, but willingly, as God would have you do it, not for sordid gain, but eagerly. Do not lord it over those in your charge, but be examples to the flock. So Paul ordains elders, and elders are a part of Jewish tradition, going back to Numbers, when Moses turns to God and says, I need help. And so there's 70 elders elected among the group. And so basically, when we're talking about elders in the New Testament, as Paul ordains elders, as he goes around, he's basically setting up pastors. They're like modern day pastors in these different communities. So Peter says, be examples to the flock. So Andy, in what ways should a pastor be an example to the flock?
Excellent question. I was in a Bible study just this morning, and they were talking about how, you know, pastors are people too. And you know, kind of insightful there. I suppose that's true. And, but, you know, we run into everyday real stuff. It's not like something magical happens when you're being ordained. Nonetheless, I mean, you need to be seeking out, like you encourage everyone else, to be following Christ, knowing that you're going to fall short just like everyone else falls short. We should never be preaching and inviting and telling people, you know, to be doing things that we're not actually doing. I mean, I wouldn't be preaching stewardship sermons if I wasn't giving. I wouldn't be preaching tithing sermons if we weren't tithing. Speed of the leader, speed of the team. You need to set the example, knowing that you fall short just like everybody else. I mean, I was reading this book a while back, 15 Characteristics of Pastors or something like that. And good Lord, there is no way I'm going to be good at all 15 of those. But there are other people in the church that are gifted where I'm not gifted. Nonetheless, you need to try and set the example. Nick, what are you thinking?
I think you hit the nail on the head. Specifically, when you're talking about stewardship, to talk about stewardship with integrity, you need to live generously. You need to live generously and model what that looks like. I think we need to live faithfully. I think in living faithfully, we pray, and you know, you model what it looks like to have a prayer life, to have a life of study. And, you know, this is part of our life of study, Andy, you and I think doing this, we're not just doing this to hang out with each other on a weekly basis, but we're studying scripture together is basically what we're doing. And we're recording it so that other people can listen. I think if you and I were together, 10 years ago, we would have these conversations, we just wouldn't record them. And that's kind of where this podcast came up. And then in service, Facebook is posting memories from 4 years ago when COVID kind of just started happening. And I remember one of the things that we did, we have about 5 acres here, and we have a lot of grass. And so we decided to stop with our lawn service because we didn't know the impact it was going to have on our finances. And so one day, me and a couple other guys, we just showed up here with our lawnmowers, and I thought it was a good way to get exercise, and it was something to do because I needed to get out of the house after being stuck at home. And so, you know, to, we just walk, mowed along here with our, and then all of a sudden we ended up getting a riding lawnmower. And it was one of those things where I'm not going to ask anyone in the congregation to show up with their push lawnmower if I'm not willing to do it. And so I think, in service and being willing to do whatever it is that we ask others to do. And I think one of the things that we also need to talk about is we need to be an example of how we show grace, to others, not take things too personal and be willing to forgive and try to overcome those things that cause conflict and drama and show grace and encourage others to show grace. I think that's an important part of what it means to be an example as well.
You know, on that forgiving piece, Nick, someone taught me once years ago, keep short accounts. That little phrase has been helpful for me. Just keep short accounts. And, you know, don't be listing, you know, in your mind some debt or list of problems someone else has. Just keep short accounts, move on. And another piece, you know, sometimes it's so easy to let other people live in your head. And I had this one leader years ago who was a real gifted business leader. And he said, never let anybody else live in your head because they're occupying their time and space. You just let go of things. Absolutely. We could go on with things. By the way, Nick, modeling things, I did do my Bible reading this morning. And the one-year Bible, Nick, I did do it. I had a very full morning. I did take the 15 minutes necessary. And so I got that done. By the way, if you're not doing daily Bible reading, we are encouraging people here to use the one-year Bible, which is just fabulous. And if it takes too long, just use the just read the New Testament part. So, Nick, I just thought I'd get that in there too. It'd be an example to people.
Not only are you an example for your congregation, you're an example to other. You're an example of piety to other pastors. Good job, Andy.
There you go. So I thought it was fun.
You deserve a statue.
I guess I deserve it. So, Nick, moving on to verse 4. Isn't it fun to pretend to be pious? And I mean, it's not that we're supposed to be. Well, we'll get to humility soon.
Well, let me ask you this. If you study the Bible and don't tell anybody about it, did you really study the Bible?
That's funny. I know that story. I don't know. I'd love to talk about it. Moving on. Verse 4 in 1 Peter 5. And when the chief shepherd appears, you will win the crown of glory, Nick, that never fades away. So throughout the Bible, Jesus is referred to as the shepherd. Last Sunday, the text, at least on the lectionary, was the good shepherd. I preached on that. What does this tell us about Jesus, Nick? Jesus as shepherd.
Well, I think it tells us the nature of Jesus. It tells us what kind of a God that we have, a God who shepherds us. And it's so comforting to know that we have a God who shepherds us. Not only did we get the reading of the Good Shepherd in John chapter 10 last week, the Good Shepherd who not only is there for the flock, but lays down his life for the flock. I mean, I didn't preach on this. I preached on, it was good Stephen Minister Sunday, so I preached a little bit on something else. Will a shepherd lay down his life for sheep? Is that a thing that happens? I guess I don't know much about shepherds, but that to me, that's the kind of, that tells us a little bit about Jesus, but also, we had Psalm 23, right? The Lord is my shepherd, I shall not want. He makes me lie down in green pastures, leads me beside still waters. He restores my soul. He leads me in right paths for his name's sake. And I would argue that text is probably one of the most famous. You got John 3:16, and you probably got Psalm 23, right? And to think about all the soldiers who are injured in war and wounded in war, and as they're dying, these are the words they hear. These are the words they think of. These are the truest words of comfort maybe in scripture. This idea that God is our shepherd and he leads us to peace, lie down in green pastures, leads us to peace, leads us to right living. You know, he leads me in right paths for his name's sake. And even though we walk through the darkest valleys, the valley of the shadow of death, we can go there because we can trust that God is with us. So that gives us comfort. So the idea of Jesus being a shepherd, and the thing about a shepherd is the shepherd is always wants what's best for the sheep and is trying to lead the sheep to the right places. And we have a God who wants to lead us and wants to guide us, but doesn't force us. And I think that's an important part of this. What do you think, Andy?
Yeah, nicely put, Nick. I don't have a lot to add to that. I did preach on it last week. And one of the things I remember from my own sermon, Nick, was that the shepherd doesn't drive the herd forward. The shepherd leads the flock. And from that, I took that Jesus, we're never going to go anywhere and experience anything where Jesus hasn't been there first through the cross. And that was one of the, I don't remember anything else I said, but that was one of the pieces I brought forward. So
it was a short sermon, is what you're saying?
No, I've no 23 minutes, if you'd like to know exactly. On the 23rd Psalm, though, I mean, it was one of those Sundays where there were so many rich texts that it was difficult to pick what to preach on. But you're right, the 23rd Psalm was one of the passages. I was thinking about, that's one of the few pieces of scripture left where you still hear people refer to it and say it using the old King James language, thy rod and thy staff, they comfort me. Really interesting to hear, you know, there's still people that, you know, really, there's something poetic about the King James that people hang on to, speaking of translations, as we did earlier.
Yeah, I love that. I love that in the King James. At times it's like, it doesn't really make a whole lot of sense, but at times it's beautiful words. And I think the beautiful words, the poetic words, are easy to remember. And so, yeah. All right, well, let's jump forward to verse 7. This is a good one here. Cast all your anxiety on him because he cares for you. Cast all your anxiety. So Peter calls us to give our anxiety to God. And in Matthew 6, Jesus said, do not worry. And if we look through the Bible, we find fear not over 100 times. Tells us not to fear. So, Andy, in what ways does fear and worry control our lives, and how is fear related to faith?
You know, Nick, this is such a tough one. You nailed it there that, you know, again and again and again, we hear Jesus saying, fear not, do not fear. You don't have to be afraid. Fear not. What is it? Fear not, little flock. You know, all over the place. Yet, how easy is it from using our own willpower to just say, okay, I'm not going to be afraid? I mean, it's nearly impossible. So, you know, it makes it difficult. And the whole notion of worry, I mean, you want to give a powerful message, you know, it's overcoming, you know, worry and fear, worry and anxiety, however you want to describe it, because people often are just gripped with this stuff and it's lingering under the surface. I mean, financially, job security, you know, worried about their kids, worried about their health, worried about all these things. And so, you know, there are so many ways that fear and worry really do control our lives. And Jesus is speaking directly into what's a very sensitive, tender area for so many of us, because we live with this. And making sense of Jesus' words where you don't have to fear, meanwhile, you know, fear is often just all over. I think one of the best, you know, exercises, challenges, practices for kids is to step into their fears and to do things that are difficult. There's a best-selling book out recently. I think it's just called Do Hard Things. And we've been trying to teach our kids, do hard things. Don't just step away from it. Step into it, and you will learn to overcome. So I'm not really answering the question, though, Nick, about how can we do life without worrying. What are your thoughts?
Well, I think it's important to the second question, I think, is a little bit, speaks to me more. How is fear related to faith? I think that specifically 4 years ago when COVID hit, there was a lot of conversations around have faith, not fear, faith over fear type of thing. And I don't really think fear and faith are opposites. I just never thought that they were opposites. I think fear is part of our ability to reason, right? As we think through things, that's where fear comes in. And it's part of the ability. It's a natural reaction to some of the things that we know are true. It's a natural reaction when we hear certain news stories, right? That's a natural reaction to be afraid of, you know, the potential for war. And, you know, I think you and I are both of an age where if war did break out, they probably wouldn't call upon us, right? We're probably a little too old for that now. I played golf yesterday. I'm a little sore today. I don't know how well I do. But, you know, I have nephews of us, you know, that are in their early 20s and late teens. And so that, you know, but instead, I think fear can be a good thing because fear reminds us of our hope, right? When we hear things that say, make us, you know, a little fearful, when we hear things that say, you know, about death, that kind of stuff, it points us to our hope. It reminds us of the promises that God has made us. It reminds us that God is with us. You know, it's so, I'm not really afraid of things for me, but I'm afraid of things for my child, right? I'm afraid of things for the people I love. But as I go through things with it, where, you know, that makes me think, oh, I should be afraid. It helps me to remember back to Psalm 23, that God is with me. And that brings comfort. But also, when we start to think about our loved ones, I think it's a time to remember that God is with them as well. God is with them as well, and God loves them, you know, probably more than we love them, because God knows them in ways that we'll never know. And the love of God is so big and so vast and so perfect that I think it's, I think fear can help us point to all the good things that God has promised for us. And I think it's natural, and I don't think we should, but I agree with you. We should try to overcome our fears as often as possible. I remember being 20 years old and working as a camp counselor and doing high ropes for the first time. Man, that was a religious experience if I ever had one. Going up 35 feet in the air and trying to walk across a balance beam and that kind of stuff. That day was, you know, I was afraid, but I'm not a big fan of heights, but you know, I overcame that fear. And when I came down, it was like the world had changed. It was like the world had changed because I had overcome a fear. And I think those are important things for us to do, and for us to challenge our children to do.
I hate heights. I'm not going to overcome that fear.
You've never done high ropes?
Oh man, I got up on one once. Yeah, I am not good on heights. That is, yeah. You know what was interesting to me on this, Nick, is when I was a mission developer and everything was new and everything was, you know, it was a challenge. And one of the mission directors was talking to the group of mission developers once. And those of you that don't know it, Nick was a mission developer, as I was. Nick is still in the church he developed. Nick won't say it, but he was very successful, is that okay to say? Mission development, fabulous congregation you lead. I've been to Nick's congregation, visited a couple of times. If you're in Texas, you should do a pilgrimage to Abiding Grace Lutheran in South Lake.
Andy, Nick, you can always say nice things about me.
What do you have, like 5 buildings now or something? So I love your outdoor space, by the way. That is
So we bought an old farmhouse that became a Montessori school. So we have 4 buildings.
Okay, 4. Okay. But, you know, the mission director would look at us and say, you know, why do pastors always lack faith? I mean, have some faith, you know, that God is in this and God is doing something and God will work through your actions. And the bigger idea was there. It's not all on us, that if we give God a chance to be at work through us, God will do something. And I think we miss that. It's not simply overcoming our fears, but it's, you know, allowing God to do something, perhaps borderline miraculous or miraculous even through us as we step out in faith. And, you know, that's what the disciples were called to do. And when they saw what God had done in Christ, boy, they all went out. They all lost their lives for it, but they all also went out and changed the world.
Yeah.
All right.
So just before you go, before we move on, Sunday night, some folks from the ELCA came to Texas and took me out to dinner and asked me a bunch of questions about, you know, things that are going on at Abiding Grace and why are things working here. And I said, well, we're very excited about the things we've done and the things we're doing, but there are other pastors out there who are doing really big, exciting things. Specifically, my podcast partner, Andy Romstad. You should call him and take him to dinner and ask him questions, so they may be calling you.
All right. Well, love what you're doing there, Nick. That is awesome. And those of you who visit Texas, go to South Lake and take up some of Nick's time. Okay. So verses 8 and 9. Thank you for that, Nick. Listen to this. Discipline yourselves. Keep alert. Like a roaring lion, your adversary, the devil, prowls around looking for someone to devour. Resist him, steadfast in your faith, for you know that your brothers and sisters in all the world are undergoing the same kinds of suffering. So, Nick, he's getting into the devil here, and Peter believes the devil is like a bully and will retreat when he is bravely resisted. And in what ways does the devil try to bully you? And does suffering make us stronger, Nick? And that's many levels there. What are your thoughts on all this?
Well, I mean, I grew up watching cartoons, right? And every cartoon eventually gets to the point where there's a scenario where there's an angel on one shoulder and a devil on the one shoulder, right? Whispering into your ear, telling you what to do. And I think that we live with that kind of temptation where the devil is constantly providing temptation and pressure, right? Peer pressure. The devil's trying to get us to do something we don't want to do. The devil's trying to get us to do something that God doesn't want us to do. And there's the temptation and there's the pressure. It might be our friends doing it. And then there's always manipulation, right? There's always that lie that we tell ourselves that it doesn't really matter if I sin. Nobody knows. It's not going to hurt anybody. Right. And so we try to manipulate, or the devil tries to manipulate us through some of the ways in which we try to rationalize things. And so we see it all over, and we see it every day. I think it's part of daily life. When Jesus talks about the devil, he refers to the devil as the father of all lies and a murderer from the beginning. And so if you see lies and mistruths being told, you know, you see the work of the devil. And where you see human beings killing other human beings, you see the work of the devil. And that is all over. And so the devil is trying to get us to do the things that God doesn't want us to do. He's trying to get Andy to do the things he does. Good thing Andy is probably as good as it gets saying no, right? But for the rest of us, we have to stand up for ourselves. We have to stand up for what is right. We have to stand up and say, no, I'm not going to do that. Even though we can rationalize reasons why it's fine, but we can't. Does suffering make us strong? I don't know. Suffering is a good, suffering teaches us. It teaches us, you know, if we make mistakes, if we do things and we hurt others and we see them suffer and maybe our lives suffer because of the mistakes that we've made, we get caught in mistakes. I think suffering teaches us. I think resistance makes us strong, right? That resistance training, weightlifting makes us stronger. That's how muscles grow. And part of what we do with our lives, when we find resistance, when things are difficult and we're able to overcome them, it makes us stronger. And, you know, there's something about what difficult times make strong people, and, you know, strong people make good times. And so, I would say difficult times definitely makes us stronger. Andy, what do you think?
Well, Nick, just so you know, I did do my weightlifting this morning, 6 a.m. I was up, got a 20-minute workout in. So,
did you really? There,
I did. So,
what are you benching these days?
That's no comment on that one. I think there were 20 pounds on the bench press. I wasn't using the bench press, but I was impressed. My son Peter got up this morning to do weightlifting as well. Awesome. You know, we're trying to lift that up. Speaking of example,
Where I was at 6 a.m. this morning?
Where were you? In bed, I guess.
Asleep.
You're asleep. Well, sleep is good for you, Nick. That's we people don't get enough sleep. But a couple of thoughts here. People ask questions about the devil, and people want to know, is it real? Is it a person? Does it look like the pictures? People, it's kind of hard. Popular culture has not necessarily been helpful in the way it's predicted, you know, the devil and who the devil is and how the devil operates and evil, et cetera. The best, in my opinion, what little I know, the best exposition on this might be in the Screwtape Letters by C.S. Lewis. And bottom line on that is, let's not overcomplicate it. He just says our problem in, you know, understanding the devil is either overbelief or underbelief in the devil. Either an unhealthy fear where you like see the devil everywhere, the devil's just in it, or kind of writing it off. And how do we deal with that? I remember years ago, the late preacher Tim Keller was preaching a sermon on how to deal with the devil. And by the way, his books are just so good. He died in 2023, but he was a preacher. I love his story. He just decided to walk into the center of New York City, like the least churched culture in the entire country, and start a brand new church. And he started Redeemer Presbyterian. But his take on it was the way to deal with the devil is to deal with your own sin. And the way he justified that was by saying the Bible says that the way you deal with the devil is to get rid of the devil's footholds. Don't give the devil a foothold. And so try and deal with your own sin. And that, you know, that's how you deal with the devil. But the idea is the devil, be it personified or evil, is real. And the devil is at work in the world. And Nick, you were talking about that. I was watching these videos the other day of the war in the Ukraine. And I mean, it's both fascinating and just tragic about, you know, these poor Russian kids, you know, young guys who wouldn't pick this in a million years are being sent to their own slaughter. And where does that come from? And how is that even? I mean, it is so wrong. It's just tough to watch. Is that evil in the devil? Yes. One other note, Nick, you were talking about, this is a question I often get. Did God cause my suffering to make me grow stronger? I don't believe God intentionally causes our suffering. God desires healing in our lives. God desires nothing but good for you. But the truth about our life is suffering is real. And I think that we can grow stronger through our suffering. And our suffering will point us to our need for Jesus Christ. So, Nick, I don't know if I caught it all, but those are some thoughts.
Yeah, those good, there. Good thoughts. You know, one of the things, one of the songs that I think best describes the devil, the Rolling Stones, "Sympathy for the Devil." Do you know that one? Do you know the Rolling Stones, Andy?
No, I've never heard of them.
Says, "Please allow me to introduce myself. I'm a man of wealth and taste. I've stole many a man's soul and faith." And, you know, the idea that this Satan is stealing souls and stealing our faith, starting wars. You know, I rode a tank in a generous rank when the Blitzkrieg in the body, you know, that Satan is there for wars and to start violence and to steal your faith in Jesus. Right. And the devil does not come to you in the form of something that you see and immediately you get scared of, but as a man of wealth and taste, right? As somebody who you will listen to, somebody who you will say, you know, whatever that person has going on, I want some of that. You know, that I think that's a scary and pretty powerful image of Satan.
Nick, this is awesome right now. You're doing a biblical exposition on a Rolling Stones tune and on the band as a whole. That is really good. Now, we're doing a series right now at our contemporary service called Playlist, and we're taking four bands. We should have had you up here to preach on this because we're doing exactly that. Last Sunday was Taylor Swift.
Nice. Well, you know that I have my Grace Abides podcast, which I haven't done in a while, but I did a whole series on pop culture theology, and I will do the theology of songs and movies.
See, I'm going to go check that out. Did you do anything on YouTube?
I don't know. Yes, I did Where the Streets Have No Name. I did a whole thing on Where the Streets Have No Name.
Excellent. Send me the link on that. I gotta use some of your stuff on Sunday. I'm preaching on YouTube on Sunday.
You can always start out at google.com.
That's awesome. The Google will find you, right? Okay, that's good.
So tell us what you're doing on Sunday.
Well, we're doing, you know, this series called Playlist, and we're just talking about how good songs ask good questions that point us to the good news. And so I started out, you know, doing a message on the Grateful Dead, which is, you know, it's this big movement. But it's an incomplete movement. Last week, Pastor Emily here did a great message on Taylor Swift and talked about her song Antihero. And I mean, it's just full of confessional theology. I mean, she's got this great lyric. It's kind of the refrain. I can't even remember, but it's me. I'm the problem. And I mean, wow, it's right out of the New Testament. And this coming Sunday, I'm going to do U2. And it was years, and it took me years to figure out that, you know, the song 40, which was one of my favorites early on, is actually Psalm 40. They just didn't put Psalm on there. You know, they don't want to sound religious, but their message is so packed, you know, talking about the sin in the world and pointing us to our needs for something beyond that. Nick, so you have clearly addressed that prior to me in your podcast. I'll check that out.
Well, it's all good stuff. It's all good stuff. And one of the things that I believe is that the world needs a whole lot more famous, faithful people, right? People who are famous, people who we love their art or we love whatever it is they do, and then they share their faith from that perspective. They share it in a way that you see a servant of God. You see somebody trying to make the world a better place. I think that's really powerful. All right. Verse 12, the end. This is the end. This is the last we're going to do of 1 Peter. It's the last question. All right. Through Silvanus, whom I consider a faithful brother, I have written this short letter to encourage you and to testify that this is the true grace of God. Stand fast in it. So, Andy, what does it mean to stand fast in the grace of God?
This is, you know, our entire life points us to our need for grace. When my dad was working at a church in Minneapolis as a seminarian, before the pastors would pray before they went out to lead worship, and the lead pastor there always used to say these words, say, give them grace, give them grace. It's what they need is grace. I remember another person at the seminary, I think, saying, you know, none of us can ever get quite enough grace. No one can ever get enough grace. But we need to lean into God's grace. I mean, I'm trying to think of the passage, but that was a big, big cling to God's grace, both in the concrete means, you know, the visible means in the sacraments is kind of, I think, what he was saying there in baptism and in the bread and wine and communion. and cling to God's promises, cling to God's grace, God's love for you, even when it's difficult. And we're people who are desperately in need of grace. And so stand fast in God's grace. Just a reminder that we're never on our own good enough. God loves us anyway, not because of what we do, but because of what he has done on our behalf. He invites us to live by faith and to cling to grace. Nick?
Yeah, I think it's a great reminder to not get caught up in works-based theology. Theology that says, I'm going to cling to my own works. So when someone who you respect and trust tells you that they get up at 6 a.m. to work out and then read the Bible for an hour, you don't have to feel guilty thinking that they're going to get in and I'm not going to get in because they're better than me. Cling to the grace of God. Cling to the grace of God. Stand fast and stand firm in it. Don't let anything make you question that God is a God of grace. And I will leave it right there.
Nicely put, Nick. I won't add anything to that.
All right. So we have finished 1 Peter, and next week we will start with 2 Peter. I think there's only 3 chapters, so it'll be a short book, and then we'll go somewhere else. But we'll finish the entire Peter portion of the Bible, and then we'll be back soon. So thank you again for listening, everybody out there. Take great care of yourselves. And Andy, we will talk again next week.
Thank you.